I was curious. I'm sure some of these pieces are some of your favorites, and these performers, I imagine, have to be some of your favorites. I see sort of bang on the can composers. I see some traditional sort of Xenakis and, you know, Messiaen here, which, you know, maybe some of the most gorgeous music Messiaen wrote, and some really fun Zhevsky things that round things out. Are these some of your favorites, and how did you get these guys to all come together?
Oh, come together.
So speak.
Yes. I mean, since you mentioned Zhevsky, I wanted to create programs that, I guess, both established a bit of a canon in a way, in terms of the seminal works of the 20th century, the late 20th century. I mean, for example, the Second Night Replay is kind of just a playful take on standard repertoire as a concept, and it's filled with standard quote-unquote new music repertoire. And, you know, it's always struck me as really strange that we still play stuff from the 80s and call it new music. Well, maybe it's a little more patently ridiculous that music from the 50s and 60s gets routinely called new today. When that would never happen, you know, the 80s are like a reference point for pop music today, but not, you know, it's dated stuff, right? And that's the idea. That's the general consensus. So I think it's interesting to establish some standard repertoire among these new composers. I love all of the pieces that are being played. I think they're amazing. The Xenakis work, Oko, is a wonderful sort of political statement, as well as just a really, really striking imaginative piece. It's written for three African djembes, and it was written, I believe, for the bicentennial of the French Revolution, I'm tempted to say, which, you know, considering the context, is a really, really powerful statement against colonialism, for example. And I think it's really interesting to talk about the possibility of music, the ability of music to articulate narratives and histories or histories that go against dominant socio-historical ones that classical music occasionally is extremely indebted to. So I think that these are ideas that are sometimes a little bit harder to articulate or even explore in traditional concert contexts. And so this was a exciting opportunity for me to really, really realize some of these things that I had inside of me.
Well, it's going to be fun. It's there at the Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn, the 11th through 13th, the Unplay Festival and unplayfestival.com. I know it, you know, you're sort of the synergy behind it. I mean, if it hadn't been for, you know, getting these awards and saying, you know, I want to do something with it, I'm sure that's, I'm bet a wonderful sort of responsibility, but a real sense of joy in bringing this together.
Oh, it's so much fun. It's a ridiculous amount of work, but it's possible because it's fun. But, you know, I'm happy to say, I'm proud to say that I am working with an amazing group of artists who are just doing a better job at realizing all these things than I ever could on my own. And more importantly, who seem to really be on the same page as I am when it comes to thinking about these things. And there's nothing quite as exciting as seeing other people kind of creating that atmosphere and having that energy and that joy about them.
I think it's outstanding for a classical pianist to do something like this, and violinist and composer, I should add. And I don't think anyone would be surprised if Wuhan and, you know, Chamber Music Society, Lincoln Center said, oh, yeah, we're going to do this Unplay Festival and whatnot. Because she's sort of been around and
I love Wuhan and David. They're such wonderful people.
They are awesome. They were just here a couple of months ago in San Antonio. And But you're 19. You're going to
I'm
be
turning 19.
You're going to be 19. So I think this is again sort of this wonderful neat thing happening that, you know, I mean, most 19-year-olds are still in school. I mean, not that you're not at school.
I am still in school, to be fair.
You know, yeah, but, you know, that aren't you know, doing international radio, you know, things and setting up a festival in Brooklyn that they can sort of call their own. I mean, that's got to be Are your parents going to be able to come? Are your friends and family dying to hear about this?
Happily, my entire family lives in New York, so if they are so inclined, they may come, and they will be there for sure. All I can say really is that I am fortunate enough to have the opportunities to realize these things and to do these things, and I'm lucky enough to have built support over the years that allows me to take some of these chances. I almost feel an obligation to myself to really keep challenging myself in this way and to be doing things that I 100% care about. I think it's extremely important.
It is, and we're tickled that you are doing this and look forward to much, much more. Is there anything you're currently composing or anything you're currently looking forward to performing here in the next year or so?
I'm currently working on a new work for the Dallas Symphony that will be performed in November, and it's observing the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. And that's a massive project, an enormous honor, and talk about responsibility. There's an interesting social responsibility that accompanies creating a work like that. And I'm very, very excited. I've worked with Jaap van Zweden, I think 3 or 4 times now, and I can't wait for that performance. But at the same time, of course, I'm also terrified.
That's a wonderful space, the Meyerson, and they do great stuff. So that's very fun.
Yeah, and it's also a nice opportunity for me to further explore some of the themes that I've been thinking about for so long now that are explored in Unplay, for example. Engagement with history is really crucial to a lot of, for example, the final night of Unplay is all about directly engaging with cultural narrative and social history. And certainly dealing with an event like JFK's assassination provides a fascinating, complicated possibility. And so I will be 19 when the piece is performed. I was born 31 years after the assassination. My engagement with it is much more on the level of the cultural historical reverberations that the event might have. And that's an interesting engagement. And I think that at first I was so scared because, I was thinking like, what can I do? How can I, in an almost perverse way, how can I do this momentous cataclysmic event justice? And then I realized it couldn't be about that. There was no possibility, and it wasn't about obviously like recalling the event or thinking about it in those terms. It was about considering the event, understanding the event, reflecting on the event. And so that's the approach I'm taking, and it corresponds nicely with a lot of the things I've already been thinking about.
There's so much that has been released since, it has happened, and whether it's major
conspiracy
motion pictures,
theories left and right.
All over the place, yeah. Major motion pictures. And then, some of the documents that, have come through and, it's a wild part of time when, nuclear war was still such of a big thing. You and I can't know exactly how that felt back in those days, but it was certainly relevant,
Well, what's fascinating to me was in my first year at Columbia, once a professor kind of, asked, if you had to name what you consider like the biggest threat right now, what would it be? And he said that in his time, it would have undoubtedly been, nuclear warfare. And shopping malls became popular because they could double as bomb shelters. And the title of the piece is called "The World Is Very Different Now." The title of the piece is "The World Is Very Different Now," which comes from JFK's inaugural address, and he was talking about the Soviet Union and talking about the imminent threat of nuclear war, and these were huge, considered and narrativized as these enormous, huge looming threats. And that was a very striking quote to me because that was a sentiment that I felt very familiar with in a complicated way. In a way, I felt in a way desensitized to that rhetoric as well as used to it. And I felt like I was growing up in a time when feeling like the world was very dangerous and people were out to get you was seen as this acceptable worldview and as, you know, as just like the real world, sort of just how things were in it. And I started feeling like these were ways of justifying a lot of strange, complex problems. And so I thought it was a very interesting idea to explore through music.
Well, we're looking forward to that. I'll keep my eye out for the DSO and the new work. I guess I'd end, and it's been so lovely to talk with you. I guess I'd end, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about maybe if you've ever seen any Annette Funicello beach movies and how these wonderful extras on the download of your Beach Boy improvisations came about, the inspiration, and how did you decide to pull these up? Because they're very fun. They're very cool.
Thank you. What filmmaker did you mention?
The actress, the old, she just passed, Annette Funicello. She did all those sort of like beach blanket bingo and that sort of.
I'm so incredibly unfamiliar with that, to be 100% honest. I am a big Beach Boys fan, though. I remember listening to the Smile Sessions, just kind of like feeling like my head was about to explode. And I wanted to do two really, really great songs. And I picked two songs, Surf's Up and I Know There's an Answer. Surf's Up being the best Beach Boys song ever, and just like I love how Surf's Up exists in so many versions at this point, and all of them sound incredibly beautiful. I love Surf's Up. It's so unconventional. It's so, talk about getting from point A to point B and just having the most magical, weird, transformative things happen between point A and point B. And then I Know There's an Answer is from Pet Sounds, which is kind of like a Sgt. Pepper type album, which I adore. It's wonderful. Brian Wilson is like one of my few like heroes, I suppose. And my favorite thing about the Smile Sessions is that I got to hear him speak, and he is this wonderful soft-spoken personality in the studio. And that was a really remarkable experience as a listener. And I hope that people can have something approaching that kind of, intimacy with it's a dream of mine that people can feel that kind of intimacy with anything I do.
Well, it's lovely. And I hope folks do the download and get the extras, because it's totally worth it.
I hope so as well.
Oh, man. It's wonderful to talk to you today, and we look forward to the Unplay Festival and all this wonderful voyages. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.